Very welcome here. I'm Erik Bergdorf. I'm President of the Economics Department here, but I lead the Institute of Global Affairs, and we are absolutely delighted to co-host another event together with New York Times. We have called this event Engaging China, so I think no one has failed to observe the growth and the reassertion of China globally. It takes many expressions, we will see during the discussion how many different expressions it takes. And New York Times has had a series of articles, and there will be some more in the next few days on this phenomenon and what to make of it, and you know what should we do to respond to this. And one thing that has been clearly noted is that there's a change in the sort of objectives of China as it has been expanding globally. It used to be about natural resources, but it's much more now about transport hubs and financial centers. And there's also difference in how these kind of investments and strategic positions are taken. And there's a lot of debate inside China, and hopefully we'll get some of that on the table about, you know, where should these investments, should China focus on its traditional investments in developing countries, or should it focus more on emerging and advanced economies? So that's a very live debate in China. Should it do these investments on its own, or should it work with partners in other countries? There are examples of Chinese institutions that do it very unilaterally, like the Silk Road Fund, for example, or the China Development Bank seems to prefer to work alone and work with Chinese companies. There are also institutions that try to work with global partners, and for example, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is not a it's not a Chinese institution, but it's an institution that has been very much influenced by Chinese thinking and has a Chinese leadership, and that institution is trying to really work with other international financial institutions. It's trying to both co-finance but also work with the same rules, often adopting the rules of the other institutions. So really trying to play along on with the global rules. And of course, this is the big question that we are facing now, and I think that's the kind of backdrop to the New York Times series. What are the rules going to be in the future if China is an important part of shaping these rules? And we have seen some signs that China wants to defend the trade rules, for example. Maybe it means different things than we do, but it has certainly made those signs, given those signs. So we have a great panel here. We have two New York Times journalists and editors, Jim Jarley, who's the European, but you also have a past in China, and Peter Goodman, who has lived in China, so did you as well, and has just written a really exhilarating piece, I thought, in New York Times the other day. So without further ado, I'm going to leave it to you, but I, of course, don't want to forget our own Professor Kuo-Yu Jin, or Jin Kuo-Yu. So she is, of course, as I think many of you know, one of the absolutely leading economists working on China and working on trying to build a conceptual framework that can help us understand what's going on in China, but also become a very important commentator on Chinese economic policies and the China's economic role in the world. So very nice to have you here, Kuo-Yu. Thank you. Jim, why don't you start to say a little bit about the background of this series of articles?
Eric, thank you very much. Can everybody hear me? Okay, so This weekend, if anybody who got the print New York Times in the United States, there was a red special section inside it that had endless stories and 30,000 words about China. And you might ask yourself, what happened? What was it that happened now that prompted the New York Times to take such a big look at China? Usually when American press looks at the rest of the world and we cover it, we tend to focus on where is a war? What's going on, say, in Syria? We might focus on elections. What's happening in Europe with the rise of populism? I lived in China from 2003 to 2009, and there were no wars and no elections. But it was a country that was fundamentally changing the world. You could see it every day, good and bad. It was a stunning thing every day in the preparation for the Olympics to watch what was happening in this massive economy and what was happening in this just the country that was the largest in the world. So it's that same element that we have. When do we decide that we need to look at what's happening in China? And this year became kind of a perfect year. It's 10 years since the financial crisis. It's the 40th anniversary of reform and opening. And there was a little thing in one of the stories that it was the 69th year of the Chinese Communist Party in control of China, which made it was sort of surpassed the tenure of the Soviet Union. The China today is nothing like the Soviet Union when it collapsed, but it was still interesting. So what we wanted to also do in this series was to sort of look at Western assumptions, what we thought engagement with China meant, what we thought it meant when I was there, what we thought it meant when Kissinger went. And obviously the end of that story is not upon us. But what the West woke up, I think, and realized this year is many of the assumptions that it had about China were wrong, were miscalculated. There were assumptions about Chinese, you know, what if as China became wealthier, how its politics might open up. There were things, ideas that, oh, you couldn't have the state playing such a large role in the economy and the economy without the economy crashing. The opposite has happened. It's one of the most dynamic and entrepreneurial economies in the world. So we took that as a moment to sort of step back and look. And we looked at different things that we thought might make China more like the West. The introduction of the internet, this sort of seemingly untamed and infinite thing that would bring information and change China more like the West, hasn't happened. We've looked at the way China has used its influence politically and economically around the world. And we've looked also at their various the idea. We had one headline on one of the stories saying the American dream is alive in China. And the idea was that social, even as incomes are still very different, that social mobility in China is, if you're born poor, your chances of rising more quickly are greater for, say, an 18-year-old in China right now than they are in the United States. That's tough to swallow for an American. You have to sort of think about that and look at it. So all of this, we engaged fantastic correspondents like Peter and other people who went all around the world. We've actually done this project that we do now, China Rules. You can interpret that many different ways. But we've also spent the year looking at different things that China is doing around the world, some of their infrastructure initiatives and things like that. We just thought this was the moment to do it. So we're very proud of it.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Grab your mic. Yeah. Hope everybody can hear me. So I was delighted to be drafted into this project because my job here is I'm the global economic correspondent. I'm based here in London, but I was based in Shanghai from 2002 till 2006. And at the time, did a series of stories on China's emergence at that point as a global economic power, and looked at all of the ways in which, you know, China's increased demand for commodities was affecting marketplaces and affecting the way the world worked. And so the assignment was to come back now in the contemporary context and ask a very similar question, and the answer is much more interesting and helped me see how, to come back to the point that Jim was making, we had not really understood what was happening in the years after China entered the World Trade Organization and proceeded with its reform and opening up initiatives. The China that I had covered back in 2002, 2003, 2004 was, to our conventional understanding, you know, a very important economic power, offering a lot of fresh demand for the goods and services of the world, exporting lots of its goods, but was largely confined to the Western-dominated / American-dominated liberal democratic order. So China's ventures abroad were mostly about, you know, going places and locking up sources of natural resources and bringing them back. I remember going to Australia to do a story on iron ore mining. I went to Sudan and wrote about how China was building lots of weapons and selling them to the Sudanese government, and the Sudanese government was clearing off land for fresh oil exploration. And most of the oil was coming back to China. We did a story on illegal logging in Myanmar. Well, so China today, of course, is everywhere and is in no way confined to anybody's model, anybody's conception of a liberal democratic order. And our goal was to go and explore how China's current mode is playing out and affecting the world. I did this story with my colleague Jane Perlez, who's our Beijing bureau chief. And Jane went to Indonesia and looked at how a whole crop of Indonesian tech startups have been financed by Chinese companies, Chinese entrepreneurs. Jack Ma has invested quite heavily in Southeast Asia. And the sense that we got from that reporting is that, you know, far from just going to Indonesia to lock up palm oil or, you know, whatever, Chinese companies are now sending people, in the case of our particular story, you know, to the same neighborhood in West Jakarta where there had been massacres of ethnic Chinese people, not once but twice in modern Indonesian history. And now Chinese people are living there, sending their kids to school there, investing in these web startups. They're there for the long haul, and that's in part because, of course, as Chinese growth moderates at home, Chinese companies have to go looking for new customers. Indonesia is creating more new internet users every day than any country on earth, so Chinese companies are there. I went off to Bulgaria to look at some of the Belt and the sort of classic Belt and Road projects, airports, power grids, looking at how much of China's global build-out now is strategic. You know, China is, on the one hand, interested in laying the ground for more commerce that Chinese companies can take advantage of, the direct creation of construction jobs if you're going to build or improve an airport somewhere, but also creating new pathways for Chinese goods to get exported around the world. And that same mode took me to Egypt to look at what I personally found the sort of most interesting takeaway in my own reporting, which is China's increasing focus on these maritime choke points. In the map of the world as conceived in Beijing, there's an understanding that to date, China's access to the world, whether it's to go get natural resources or to export its wares, is dependent on friendly relations with the United States because the U.S. patrols the global shipping lanes, and China is always vulnerable to potentially being cut off from that access if there are hostilities with the U.S. Obviously, we're now in a moment where that no longer sounds impossible to imagine, and so far from simply looking to export more of its wares, China is looking to make trade deals
to engage in commerce with the powers in control of the key choke points where access to the rest of the globe could potentially be impeded. And one such place is the Suez Canal. It's a vital shipping lane. It's controlled by the Sisi government, increasingly viewed as a pariah for breaches of democratic norms, constrained in terms of capital, and has this grandiose idea of building this new Egyptian capital to replace Cairo, which is somewhat crumbling, it's traffic choked, it's dirty, and they're building this new city out of nowhere. And I have to say, as someone who spent a lot of time seeing new Chinese cities growing over the last 20 years, even by those standards and that scale, it was astonishing to see a city that is slated to be bigger than Dubai. It just goes on forever in the middle of, you know, blank desert, and China's largest construction company has gotten this contract directly from the Egyptian government to build 120 skyscraper, 21 skyscrapers all in one shot, including one taller than the Empire State Building. And we looked at that as an example of China's focus on the maritime choke points. You get $3 billion in finance from a state-owned Chinese bank. The money goes directly to the Egyptian government. The Egyptian government borrows it on direct condition that it hire a Chinese construction company to do the work. And voila, suddenly there's a Dubai rising from the deserts of Egypt. And finally, you know, you can read the piece if you want more detail than this, but there's an exploration of what this means for those who care about the liberal democratic order. Not to make a simplistic moral judgment, you know, we live in a time when the supposed architect of the liberal democratic order, the United States, is run by a president who seems not to buy into many of its central tenets, which certainly creates an opportunity for a would-be leader like Xi Jinping, who, despite being accused of stealing intellectual property and subsidizing state-owned enterprises, has credibly staked out a position as the defender of the rules-based international trading system. You know, putting that aside for a second, what is the impact of this alternative source of capital, not just in Egypt, but in countries around the world, where Chinese finance, very well-financed pockets, are available for a range of construction projects with no rules on labor standards, with no rules on environmental standards, with no requirement that there be competitive bidding. The only real rule is you can't criticize Beijing and you have to give a piece of the action to Chinese companies. Whatever one thinks of that, that's clearly a change in how the global economy works. And so that was one of the things we tried to explore. Why don't I leave it there? I'd love to hear any questions.
Thank you very much. I think you gave a very live depiction of the article itself, because it is exactly that, those images, those vignettes from different parts of the world that really poses some very fundamental question. There are debates in China about, you know, what are the best strategies and where should China put its capital, you know, where there's a lot of criticism of, I think, of previous investments in, for example, developing countries, and that the returns have not been at all what they were supposed to be. How does this look from the point of view of China, do you think?
Well, let me start by maybe framing the issues that we've heard, the issues that have been described on the ground and what's actually happening, and really putting into context, because I think there are two key questions of our era. One is, what does the China-U.S. relations look like? And that's one of the key problems of our era. And the second related, not unrelated, issue is, what is going to be the defining characteristics of a Chinese global leadership? We don't know what that is, and I'm not sure they know what that is either. The United States post-war U.S., there was a clear kind of mission, kind of upholding moral universalism, some kind of a value system that they think could apply to a range of countries. Now, China has absolutely no interest in exporting any of its system or values or anything like that. So the way that I see all of this foreign engagement, because that is what President Xi wants to leave as a legacy is what is the global role that China will play. Because Deng Xiaoping's mantra that China can somehow grow peacefully and quietly, those days are over. That helped China a lot. Actually, Americans helped, you know, China get into the WTO, assuming that that would open up the political system. And by now, China should be a democracy already. So that was one of the wrong assumptions of that initiative. So since those days are over, China needs to define its role. And I think the Belt Road Initiative, kind of the setting up a new globalization model, which is not just about trade and capital flows, but really setting up a platform for international cooperation, or at least that's the idea. And we'll come back to in terms of, you know, how they're executing, of gathering different countries' comparative advantage, whether it's capital, technology, resources, in building infrastructure. Because we have to face it, the world is in a deficit of infrastructure. I mean, I don't think anyone really admires the Kennedy Airport, JFK Airport these days, right? But Beijing happens to have one of the best, you know, most advanced airports. We've been talking about developing countries because China has developed this core competency in very low, in terms of low cost and productively building out infrastructure. That's part of, that's an important, critical, vital element of China's rise. So building this new platform of cooperation is, I believe, one of the things that China wants to do in terms of economically pragmatic goals. That is, rather than, you know, exporting any kind of systems and values. And if anyone has learned more about Chinese history, China also always has been kind of proud of its own cultural preeminence, never needed to feel that it wanted to, you know, kind of export anything beyond in terms of the culture and values. So I think if one is fearful of the intentions to kind of have this global influence through anything that is other than economics, I think, you know, you're reading China wrong. Mm-hmm. Now, look, South China Sea, military, all that could be coming into the discussion. But look, South China Sea is very close to Chinese borders. China cares less, much less about the Caribbean seas than it does about the South China seas. So that's one. What is the defining characteristics of the Chinese global leadership? We all know, as students of economics, the core tenet of international trade is comparative advantage. We can no longer see China as just a cheap labor country. Those days are over. Today, China's core competency or comparative advantage is precisely in things, you know, that was mentioned in terms of building, you know, having this construction capability, this production team, this, you know, workers and laborers, and understanding building out power grids and infrastructure very, very fast. That's one of China's comparative advantage. Now, where did it come from? I don't think it just came from nowhere. I actually want to attribute this to part of China's development model. What I consider fallacious about Chinese development model and what really explains today's macroeconomic problems, whether it's high debt, high leverage, financial fragility, excess capacity in the form of not only steel, but also, you know, exporting infrastructure and capital. All of this comes from this fundamental development model, which is the state uses the financial system as a tool to advance its key objectives, key industrial policies, and that's what's producing the excess capacity. If all those resources were diverted to the households and to the private sector, they would not be doing infrastructure. So we got to look at today's kind of comparative advantage as potentially a good thing for the world, because actually China is subsidizing infrastructure development in the rest of the world. China is also subsidizing the making of electric cars, subsidizing your sneakers, your clothes. I mean, why is everyone complaining about that? It's the Chinese people that is subsidizing these things when they export it cheaply. But it comes from this fallacious kind of development model, economic model, which China has relied on for the last decades and is now transitioning out of. Trade war is actually one of the key kind of triggers for China to move out of that development model that relies on state-owned enterprises and exports, and it's happening right now. We're seeing a lot of these measures to implement these reforms happening right now. So the bottom line is China is going to start to strengthen the households and the private sector and move away from this. So we don't know how much longer this excess capacity, this kind of model is going to persist. Now, today's the tension with the U.S., with even the European countries, it's way beyond trade war. Trade war is only a short-term symptom, a manifestation. Now, maybe it really is the preoccupation of President Trump, that I believe, but it will last way beyond President Trump's tenure. Because ultimately, this tension is about Chinese aspirations, the Chinese development model, and Chinese technology. You suddenly have a country, as was just mentioned, starting from not much. I mean, I remember, you know, I became a high school student in New York in 1997, and China was important, but not that important. The only three things that people knew when I said I came from China is Tibet, Tiananmen Square, and human rights. Those were the only things that people mentioned, you know. But now, today, all these students are going to China to live the American dream, right? So it's over these kind of issues. You have this country that is, you know, communist, very different ideologically, different kind of development model, and it's becoming richer and richer in the second largest economy and going to overtake as to become the largest economy soon. And you have really advanced technology. So, you know, in the other room I was mentioning, this is probably the first time in history that a country with only a quarter of the living standards of an advanced economy is spearheading some of the major cutting-edge technologies in the world. And that is what is also threatening. And also how the Chinese government is perceived to be using this technology is what is threatening to the rest of the world. So I think that it's clear that there's a lot of compelling evidence that China, whether it's, you know, going to be the largest economy or what really is going to be the defining characteristics of the global leadership, these are all really important questions. But I want to bring a caveat here. Some of these discussions, a lot of this discussion actually occurred a few decades ago about Japan. Actually, in the 80s, Japan was leading in many fronts of technology. I mean, the American administration, when they went to visit Japan, they were just wowed by, you know, the piano that was composing its own music or something like that in the 80s. And, you know, and they really were very concerned that Japan would also become a technological leader. And back then, we had a professor at Harvard who was famous for, but turned out to be wrong because he wrote Japan Number One, that as a book, right? Look at how what happened. So it's not clear that that story wouldn't repeat itself because subsidizing manufacturing is not the same thing as subsidizing technology. So we just want to kind of keep that clear that China is not yet out of the middle income trap or is sure to escape it. China is not necessarily going to be a technological leadership. But in the end, with a very different country such as China and the U.S., I think the best we can hope for is a different but harmonious coexistence. Thanks.
Thank you. You said now that we should be grateful to China because China is now building all this infrastructure for the rest of the world. And of course, that's true, but of course what's worrying there is that if this infrastructure is not built to the standard, particularly environmental and other standards that are going to be actually crucial for dealing with some of the global challenges. You know, we have a window of 10-15 years now where a lot of this infrastructure has to be put in place. How do you see China taking this? It's clear that inside China, yeah, there's a lot of stress on these environmental standards and so on, but will China take this
actually,
outside China?
Incidentally, before this talk, I was at a forum, a Belt and Road Initiative with Chen Yuan, and it was green bond financing as part of the Belt and Road, so I thought this was very appropriate. You know, absolutely. I also wanted to mention that I forgot to mention that one of the things that will make China much more powerful is not the $60 billion invested in Africa, but just a little bit more soft power. And China has not been very good on soft power. And that includes understanding what the world needs, understanding local cultures and local customs. But I think that the push for environmental green standards is very, very much on the policy agenda. Now, I listened to the things that were said on the forum, and China is leading in many issues on environmental, and I think they have put more stress. But again, I'm not an expert on exactly what's happening.
I was just curious, and I'm not an economist, but you said China is subsidizing infrastructure in the world. But it's the Chinese people that are doing that because of the economic model. Essentially, they're pouring into this model they're transitioning out of. And actually, if you're one of the recipients and you default on your debt, you have to pay your debt anyway. There are lots of examples that are growing of countries. We did a story about Sri Lanka, where China now controls the port that they built for the Sri Lankan people because of the same model. I mean, I think that even as it's obvious that many Western assumptions didn't play out, I don't think China goes into the world with an apolitical lens, given that you say that everything is about its economy, but the scale of its economy is is what the party depends on for its survival. You know, the delivery of standard of living is on the Chinese economy, and if you have overcapacity in all these different industries, they have to carry that around the world for their own political survival. Is that not right?
Certainly, it's going to be a very difficult thing to debate, and I don't want to go into the debate whether how much of this political, geopolitical, strategic, or economic. I think it's an element of both. I think the Marshall Plan in the past was an element of both. It's very hard to, you know, argue one way or another. But if we really tabulate all the data, you know, what they're investing in, where they're investing in, what are the opportunities, it's kind of really, you know, it covers a wide range. Just as, you know, in Africa, it's not just resources. Now they have all kinds of manufacturing and light industries that are, you know, that covers, you know, dozens of sectors. So I think if we look at the data more specifically, it paints a more complete picture of what that is. Certainly there will be instances where, you know, it's more debatable. But political legitimacy domestically has very little to do with what President Xi is doing outside. It is absolutely to do with anti-corruption in China itself and the domestic political situation in China. So I see more of the outward, you know, kind of initiative, still not as the primary focus of President Xi. It took him 5 years to do the corruption cleaning, and it's not done yet.
I guess I do want to push back on this idea to echo where Jim's headed, that there's this sort of apolitical, you know, China doesn't do politics, doesn't involve itself in the politics of other countries, is just interested in trading, is not exporting a kind of ideology. I mean, to go into developing countries and to lend money with requirements only that Chinese companies get the work and that Beijing not be criticized for its various engagements in China and outside of China, I mean, that is a kind of ideology. That is a sort of political model. Now, one can legitimately criticize the degree to which those who built the liberal democratic order lived up to their own rhetoric. And certainly part of the appeal of what I think we can now call the China model or the China rules is that, as we saw in 2008 in the global financial crisis, so much of the Western advice that was given for years, you know, Chinese central bankers would be told by visiting American Treasury secretaries, you have to open up your capital market, you have to move faster to open up your capital market. And then 2008 comes along, and China, intelligently, having not followed that advice, is spared most of the carnage and is then in a position to actually go and rescue through strategic investments some of the same American banks that had been dispensing all this advice. So, you know, I don't want to suggest that there's some sort of paragon within the Western liberal democratic order, But I don't think you can genuinely argue that China is doing something other than exporting its own model. I mean, China has brought into creation the Asian Infrastructure Bank, which now rivals the World Bank in terms of volume of deals, and does seem to be steering a lot of its business to Chinese players. Moreover, I mean, I sat in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria, at the 16+1 summit. This is this grouping of 16 Central and Eastern European countries and China. I mean, it's all about let's bring together the countries that need capital with the one country that actually has all the capital. 10 of the 16 Central and Eastern European countries are members of the European Union, and the European Union looks on with real alarm and says, you know, we're trying to deal with Hungary and Poland breaching democratic norms and the norms of the European Union, and the one lever we can pull is we can threaten to withhold development assistance, and in comes China with a potentially infinite checkbook. You know, if you're someone who cares about European norms and values, that's potentially a threat. I sat 8 feet from Li Keqiang, the premier of China, who said for the third time that day, you know, we are going to have competitive bidding in all of our projects. We are not here to divide Europe. And I was sitting literally right behind the Serbian prime minister, who I just talked to 30 seconds ago, and I asked her about Chinese funding for this high-speed rail connecting Budapest to the capital of and I said, well, is that going to be competitively bid? And she said, oh, no, China is our strategic partner, there will be no tenders. So, you know, the world is complicated, and there are no pure good guys or bad guys, but I think it's fair to say that China's engagement in the globe is changing the nature of business and creating an alternative and in some ways that's a good thing. You know, if you're in Africa and you don't have access to capital to build a road and along comes China, that is potentially an opportunity, but you better be clear that there are some strings that are not so obvious that are attached to that money, and we have to look at the consequences.
I think that, you know, my job is not to defend any of this about China, because I think that China's Belt and Road Initiative has a series of challenges on its own right. But two observations. One is, what is the alternative? If China doesn't help build this stuff, it doesn't get built. And by the way, the U.S. played much of that role in bearing a much, you know, disproportionate amount of cost for either NATO or, you know, kind of organizing these kind of world initiatives. And now there is, you know, it's receding from the global stage. These things, they just don't get built because these governments are small and they are poor. And you need all kinds of coordination ability. You need a big player to not only be able to absorb the risk of liquidity, construction risk, operational risk, financial risk. You need a big player. So the other alternative is nothing gets built. Now, my experience with Sri Lanka, having, you know, talked to some of them, they said, well, look, you know, some of our governments are using China as a political kind of card. One party will win if, you know, we're anti-China, one side of the will win the election. And they said, so one of the governments sided with India and the U.S. against China, you know, thinking that the money would come to help the development, and it didn't come. So they went back to China to ask for money. So China, would you come back and cooperate? My sense is that it has to be a two-way street, right? A lot of these countries are so excited that China is having this program and can actually invest in these countries. In September, I was in Ukraine. All they could ask me was, how can we engage China more for this Belt and Road? How can we attract them more to do this investment? Actually, you mentioned Serbia. This weekend, I was, you know, discussing with the biggest Serbian businessman. They said now they're so happy. You know, China has become the biggest, best, you know, friend. So, to your point as well. But they have been desperately trying to fund the infrastructure that would connect the port with the inland. If it's not for China, who will get it done? I mean, America certainly is not going to take up that role, right? So I don't want to say that there's no political aspirations, there's no problems, there's a huge amount of problems, and this is why I mentioned the soft power issue, or broader, you know, understanding of the human condition, and all of that is important. But otherwise, development is on the standstill because these governments are poor and they don't have money and they don't have the coordination abilities.
Well, that's correct. But that, you know, that's the same thing that the subprime mortgage lender said. You know, well, who's going to give these people a mortgage if not us? I mean, we have to look at the terms. That's not to say that it's wrong for China to lend to build infrastructure. And there is no question that China is operating in a time when an alternative source of capital is very much needed. But we better have our eyes open about what the terms are and who's getting the benefits.
I think, you know, you were talking about that the U.S. and China now are in a fundamentally different relationship, and then that relationship going forward in the future is the most important thing in the world. How will that play out? And the likelihood, we see Trump and we see his sort of antagonistic language, and the idea that you know, this is going to be a much uglier relationship. And now I know you have thoughts about Trump, and he could be a good thing for China in some ways. But I think beyond it all, if China wants to export its own, if Belt and Road is a development platform, and if it doesn't project values, but its lack of that is a type of value, it gets to the what you're saying, I think, which is that during the period of time when the United States fought and hoped that China was evolving into a more politically open system, there was ground for trust. There was ground for a sort of shared political space. I think this year when Xi Jinping threw out term limits to be the president, in the West, that was a huge wake-up call for people who pay attention to politics. And they looked and they said, oh, maybe not. And so, I mean, going forward, one of the things I'm genuinely curious about, this has been one of the most beneficial economic and political relationships in the world. How is that going to, where is trust going to be found? I mean, I know you're not speaking for China. I'm just curious. I mean, no, I'm genuinely curious what you think, because that is really like we see Trump and he's sort of a caricature in many ways, and as a loud American. But I do think, you know, I think who knows what will happen politically in the United States. But I do think that, let's say in the election 2 years from now, Trump doesn't win and someone comes in and begins to do what Trump did to Obama, which was reverse a lot of things. I don't think they'll do a dramatic turnaround on China. I think you're right. You know, I have a feeling we've entered a new place where we were headed to begin with, and Trump has just sort of accelerated it.
Yes. So the Chinese view is that this is a struggle that will stay around for some time to come. And I can give you what the Chinese perspective is. I think I know what the American perspective is. You know, American perspective being, well, China is no longer a poor country, benefits so much from the global system, stop, you know, stealing the intellectual property rights, time to give back. And, you know, that's kind of, and, you know, technology and how China's going to use the technologies, all these concerns. You know, amidst the, like, millions of five-year plans or something like that, there's, like, a free acceptance that China wants the Americans to acknowledge, or that's how China sees the future relations unfold, is that accept that because China is big, by that populous, therefore it is going to be very big in terms of GDP, not because it's rich, but because it's big. So just accept that, right? Number two, that China is going to tolerate. Now, because China is big, it's inevitable that China will play a bigger role in the global community, right? And it's kind of bumping its way around with all these challenges that you have mentioned, but it will, by necessity or by default, just play a bigger role, especially in the region. However, China is going to tolerate a vast richness of, like, differences, whether it's religious, political systems, or whatever. It's going to accept that countries are different. I think it's a very, you know, kind of, we can obviously go in and talk about what that means, but it is some kind, somehow a profound view of what, you know, what this is about, just tolerating differences and accepting differences. And thirdly, that when it does exert more global leadership of its own kind, that it will be of a different nature. Not, again, not specific as to what that is. Coexistence is a key word they want to emphasize, and different but harmonious is a key word they want to emphasize. But look, you know, it's hard. You've asked a very, you know, tough question. How does that trust build? Because if they're funding infrastructure and trying to do some economic good, that gets pushed back. If they're having greater influence in the world, it can be read in so many different ways, right? It could be, it's a double-edged sword. But actually, you know, America has many more tools and much more potent tools than trade war. Actually, trade war is like a war of endurance, which, you know, the Communist Party is very good at, endurance. It emerged as victors because of its ability to endure hardships. So that's not really a game that, you know, China will necessarily lose. But the power comes from the students and technology and education. These are tools that America really has that could be levered, you know, when if levered, used on China, could be much more painful. So, you know, it's my hope that, part of my hope and part of this trust, I believe, is going to come from the younger generation. Now, I've looked at a lot of surveys because I'm very interested in the post-80s new generation, the one-child policy generation. It's very, very clear that their attitude towards the West, towards even Japan, is much more open and much more friendly and much more open-minded about information flows and exchanges than previous generation, decade by decade. However, so that was once my hope. However, what's happening today by labeling China as the key rival to the U.S. is inciting nationalism, unfortunately, and among the youth. It's actually giving more legitimacy to the left part of the political party that is kind of has this pre-social, you know, socialist, you know, pre-Mao or, you know, going to back to Mao kind of sentiment. And that is very, very dangerous. So it's really important what we say as, you know, kind of things that will influence the younger generation, which has always been my hope to build that trust.
And for we have a very numerous audience here. I want to bring you in if I can. So if you could just introduce yourself, be brief, you please pose questions. There are microphones, and this is, by the way, being recorded, so okay. Take that, have that in mind. So are you? Yes.
Hi, my name's Yao Ming. I'm ethnically Chinese, but I'm actually British. I was British born, so I grew up in the West. So probably my question comes from that perspective. Now, the way the debate seems to be going, it seems to be more like a values argument, isn't it, really? But isn't it time that, isn't it high time because of, like, there is a challenger, basically, to the West, and there hasn't really been a challenger for the last few hundred years. Shouldn't the West be thinking, you know, can it continue to try to remake the world in its own image? You know, especially given the last couple of decades, you know, how can it claim to champion human rights given, you know, the last two decades of hypocrisy, really, in its foreign policy?
Yeah. Okay, I'll take two more questions and then...
Thanks. Robert Wade. I'm in the Department of International Development here at LSE. I wonder if the panel could tell us something about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which has been described as the most important international organization that nobody's ever heard of. That there are obviously great tensions between the members of that organization, and the question is how these tensions are being handled.
Thank you. And over there.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm a student. Like Yao Ming, I have a hyphenated Chinese identity. I'm Chinese-American. I kind of want to turn the last talking point about how this China-America rivalry breeds nationalism in China on America and the New York Times reporters. I'm curious about what public sentiment in the U.S. is about towards China, and like how maybe this new reporting directly or indirectly might engage with that.
Okay, so it's about values. It's about nationalism.
Okay, I can take a stab at a couple of them. I'll leave the Shanghai cooperative. I mean, I do remember that when I was there, and it was just starting out, and everyone in the West kind of thought, well, what is this exactly? And they paid little attention to it, but it basically aligned, if I'm back in my day, it aligned Beijing with the stance with Central Asia pretty effectively. I don't know how it's changed, so I'll leave that to you all. Clearly, the West is having its own crisis of values right now. I mean, there's no question about that. Whether it's a critique of neoliberalism and the economic model, you know, and not necessarily a values economic critique as projected onto other countries, but you see it in inequality in wealthy democratic countries. You see it in a variety of ways. You know, in both Europe and the United States, there's been the equivalent of a political revolt of what we would call populism, people, angry candidates who are questioning democratic political order in some cases, who are doing that in the name of people who don't feel like they've gotten their fair share. Now, of course, in Donald Trump's case, he often blames China for that. But I think, obviously, it's something bigger than that. So you mentioned hypocrisies in foreign policy. I mean, who would argue with that? Every country has hypocrisies in foreign policy. China very firmly in that same camp. So I think that, you know, when we talk about building trust, it's China is in a transition right now that we've talked about, and Xi Jinping is sort of the face of that, is a stronger, more powerful, more outward-looking Chinese leader. But the Western world, if you can lump it together like that, which might not be fair, is having its own reexamination, and it's happening largely through elections, which would be different. As far as nationalism in the United States, another good question. I think it's tied directly to it. I think that Trump has certainly embraced economic nationalism. I mean, America First is just, you know, when it first started, I think he didn't even realize what it was rooted in, which was Lindbergh and back in a different era. But I mean, economic nationalism now, as many people are buying into it, is, you know, we have to put American interests first. We're more transactional, which actually is sort of in some ways more like a certain type of Chinese, you know, transactionalism that has existed in different ways in their economic relationships. You can argue that. But I mean, nationalism in China and in the United States are also things that politicians manipulate. I do think it's true that I do think it's true that when you were saying that if outside media and the rest create this sort of bipolar dynamic of China versus the United States, it can drive a certain type of nationalism, particularly on the political left in China, certainly. But I mean, we should be honest about the fact that nationalism is a tool, and this was included in what we wrote about, that Chinese leaders use, that Xi Jinping uses, that he uses. When I was there, it was used very aggressively against Japan, because at the time, the Chinese relationship with Japan was one sort of equals vying for preeminence in East Asia. I think it's fair to say that battle is largely over. But so nationalism is something that can come organically, but it can also be manipulated, and politicians in both China and the United States are doing it right now.
I just want to pick up on this interesting question about
views of China in the United States. You know, one of the things that I'm very pleased about in this series, and I don't represent this, is that much of the work in this series is produced by people who are both native Chinese and native English speakers. People on the ground who are able to pick up on what's happening around them without translators, without having to be, you know, living in the context and absorbing the views of a great range of people. Because I think there's no question that historically and right up till today, in any American treatment of China, this was the case in the critique of Japan's rise in the 80s. You know, you have to talk about race. I mean, race is in everything, and certainly understandings of race are operative in terms of how the U.S. is grappling with a powerful China that, for perfectly legitimate reasons, is going to demand respect that's commensurate with its size and representation on world bodies. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, to Jim's point, China has become a very effective way for American politicians to oftentimes deflect blame for what are homegrown economic problems. It's interesting. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about this. The American dream is alive. It's in China. Yeah, one reading of that is there's more mobility now in China than there is in the United States. You could look at the same chart and also be shocked to see that there's more mobility in just about every large economy on earth than there is in the United States. I mean, it starts with the Nordics off on the right. Italy, I was shocked to see in that chart, has more economic mobility than the United States. So, you know, the U.S. grappled with China's inclusion in the World Trade Organization in 2002, and in the aggregate has been an incredible beneficiary of China's inclusion in the World Trade Organization. I mean, consumer goods are cheap, they're available. The problem is that the United States has done a very poor job dealing with the distribution of the spoils, and the U.S. has failed in terms of job training. The U.S. has fallen behind, to Professor Jin's point, on education. So the U.S. has failed in many respects to exploit a very strong hand in the global economy. I mean, the United States is no weakling in the global economy, and yet to hear the political conversation about China, it's as if, oh, we're so helpless. Oh, my goodness, they're playing by these other rules. Now, I may sound like I'm contradicting myself, because they are playing by other rules, and I think there's a very legitimate critique that can be made about China, and it's living up to its own agreements under the WTO, and you can question whether the WTO was even built to deal with an enormous developing economy that's quasi-communist, quasi-capitalist, you know, living by these rules. But the point is, these depictions of race certainly go hand in hand, just as there's a sort of demonization of immigrants now. You know, you blame the Mexicans and the Central Americans coming over the border. You blame unfair competition from China. And then you don't have to have a conversation about how do you run what is still the world's largest economy so that more people benefit. And I think, you know, to your point about human rights, there is built in to the American / Western narrative that, you know, our way is the way, and modern history is about other countries evolving to eventually end up, you know, with our template. And clearly, what we've seen from China directly challenges, just on a pragmatic level, you know, how that's going to play out. And it does seem like a good moment to examine the degree to which it's helpful to us to impose what are not really universal values on the treatment of every subject. That's not to, you know, accept and forgive clear violations of human rights in China and in other countries, but it is to say that there's no clear universal template that we're all living up to or evolving toward.
I think it sounds like nobody will disagree with me on this panel that things are evolving. Things are changing on both sides. So what we observe today, we observe in the last 20 years, is not necessarily going to be the status quo, because the Chinese system is also evolving. It sounds like the Western, you know, liberal order is changing slowly and surely in some ways, too. And so I think, you know, if you look at the even the social and political development that has happened in China in the last 20 years, 30 years, I think it would be fair to say that much has changed, and it will continue to change. So nothing is really quite fixed. And I think this is why engaging in such debates that bridge the two perspective is potentially very important in shaping that path. I just also want to mention that I still feel that it's interesting, as I sometimes talk to, you know, various people around the world, that there is also the courting China on the other side. And what is happening, the kind of rising tension between China and the U.S., and in fact, a lot of these investments, the last two, you know, the M&A's deals, the investments that were going into the U.S. has all been kind of canceled. They have also been canceled in Portugal and Spain, and you have lots of instances where the rules of the game also changed after, you know, money went into Chinese money, and, you know, China also suffered large losses. But Brazil is now a country that really wants to engage more with China, wants to attract the investments, and even this country, you know, maybe it's a just, you know, selection bias of which kind of conferences I end up, but every time the UK is, how can we get China to put in more money into this country to fund this infrastructure? So I think ultimately, if it's really just a one-sided street, a one-way route, this is not going to be sustainable either. Just as 10 years ago, China realized that what it was doing in Africa in the earlier years of resource exports was not sustainable, because that was not going to be a mutual two-way street eventually. And that's why it invested in, you know, other things, and hospitals and medical, and, you know, so it's slowly learning these lessons. But I think that, you know, if it's really a two-way street, and I agree with you, it's really about the terms and the conditions, and also the recent you know, rise in the risk of default of the bonds is a very, very important issue that I don't even think China is aware of the potential financial consequences of, you know, over indebtedness of these small countries. So I think all of these are a work in progress, but, you know, let's stay tuned to see how they evolve.
And we have some recent experience, the Venezuela, for example, that where China has to put a pretty large bill. And so there are many examples of testing these relationships. So anyone else up here?
Hello. Okay. I'm Vainis. I'm just a visitor here, and I'm from Lithuania. And one subject that's very interesting for me is China's and Russia's relationship, and what impact it will have on Russia's influence in the region, especially in Eastern Europe. Will it more enable the regime, or will it be more of a competitor?
Will China more enable the Russian regime?
Yeah.
Oh.
So you had one more question here? Here.
I am Deng Jingyuan. I'm just Chinese. So
there are a few of those.
I'm very interested in the analogy Dr. Jin drew between China and Japan. And I have a question for you. So do you think if there were a hypothetical financial crisis in China, do you think China will fall into the same stagnation as Japan did in the past two decades? And to the editors of the New York Times, I wonder if... apologies, but...
He has a much more fun job.
So, if China were to fall into a stagnation economically, what would happen to the world order when the U.S. is already in retreat and the West is in relative decline?
We will take one more question.
Oh, anybody wants that? Yeah.
There's one, Victor.
Hello. David, commercial aviation student. Back in the Cold War, the Americans, they were preoccupied because the Russians were influencing, or they were influencing Latin America with their ideology. Today, we have China as the second most important foreign investor. So for the New York time team, is America preoccupied today for the role of China in the region? And given the fact that more Latin American countries are recognizing China and they are stopping, they are not recognizing Taiwan anymore as part of a, as an individual a country. And to Dr. Jin, with what eyes should we look at the Iranian and China relation? Thank you.
Wow. Well, we cover a lot of ground here. I don't know.
I feel like I should take my coat off. Yeah, yeah. First of all, I can't imagine that. I mean, what's made the this was the stagnation question from the and Dr. Jen can talk about Japan, but what's made the America-China relationship so good is its mutual dependence. You know that it's 20, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have, if you were in the United States, you wouldn't have really tried. What happened in China and China's economy wouldn't have been seen as something that affected your life. I think many people now certainly recognize that it is, and that, you know, for all of the differences and talks about the way these different models work, I think everyone recognizes that if China went through a really serious economic crunch, it would have global ramifications that would be negative, would be strongly negative, and to the United States. I don't think anybody wants that. Now, I guess maybe Peter Navarro wants that, but I don't know. But I was thinking about something when we were talking earlier, and we were talking about politicians and how they've essentially used this relationship against each other at times. And I forgot to mention something that was quite interesting. We don't even remember this now, but I can't remember the exact date. It was about 4 months. It was about April of 2001, and two airplanes collided over Hainan Island. There was an American fighter jet, I think, and a Chinese jet, and the American jet went down. George Bush was a new Republican president. His poll ratings were horrible. And everyone thought this was going to be the moment that the China-America relationship was going to become combative. Something happened a few months later called 9/11, and that changed everything. And the Americans immediately went to Beijing, said, you know, we don't want any trouble. And then they went off on 15 or however many years of adventurism in the Middle East, which has obviously, you know, been pretty devastating in many multiple levels for the United States. And that created space for China to essentially have a 15, 18-year period where the United States was largely preoccupied. So in that period of time when China was smartly going to Latin America, going into Africa, and as Dr. Jin says, their model changing and what they want out of that, you know, if it was commodities before, it's changing. But the United States, you know, you're right, they were less engaged. They were less focused on what was going on. So now I think the U.S. has to look around the world and figure out, you know, what it's doing in places like that. And actually before Trump, I guess Obama's efforts to do the trade alliance in Asia was sort of an effort at that, I guess. But I don't know.
Well, it is ironic that Obama talked about the pivot to Asia as if, well, what were you doing before if we weren't paying any attention to Asia? I mean, all you have to do is look at the map and see where people live and where goods are coming from and who owns American public debt to see that Asia is always going to be a place that you have to pay attention to. I mean, in terms of the question of you know, is the U.S. preoccupied with other issues? Is not, you know, I'm not an insider. I'm sitting here in London. I'm not in Washington. But it seems fairly clear that the Trump presidency is about competing power centers within the Trump White House, jockeying for Trump's ear
And the results of that jockeying seem to change from day to day, almost like a reality television show. I mean, it's hard to imagine that there's a truly coherent Latin America policy any more than there's a, you know, coherent position on what to do about the Uyghurs. This is a White House that seems to deal with the crisis of the moment. And Latin America just right now is treated as a place that doesn't seem to be of tremendous interest. This interesting question about Japan, I mean, I've always thought, you know, I think it was, you know, back in 2001, a guy named Gordon Chang wrote a book called The Coming Collapse of China, which predicted that within 5 years, the Communist Party would disappear and there'd be a revolution. And the amazing thing is Gordon Chang still goes on television prognosticating about when this inevitable thing will happen. He keeps moving the date, yeah. I've always thought this idea that there would be this giant collapse of China is just, you know, absurd. I mean, China prints its own money. China has $3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, is a manufacturing colossus, now has tremendous internal, you know, domestic demand, can power its economy based on that. But this question of Chinese indebtedness, which, you know, Professor Jin can correct me if I've got this wrong, seems to be of real concern to senior party officials in China. That's a serious scenario. I mean, if China doesn't get a handle on its debt and continues to waste its capital, it does seem conceivable that you could go through, you know, in Japan they call it the lost decade, now going on, you know, two plus decades. You could go through substandard growth. You could fail to produce enough jobs. And that could have very serious consequences, certainly domestically in China, where you still need large numbers of jobs for people entering the workforce. And then ultimately you could get to a place where China continues to dump excess capacity onto global markets, which increases trade tensions, could manipulate the currency, which could provoke, you know, long after Trump, a non-nationalist American president who at that point might be aligned with the Europeans, to take significant action. And, you know, that could play in all sorts of directions, but a lot of them are bad. It would be a bad thing for China to suddenly see its economic engine sputter.
Well, continuing on that topic, in the last couple of years, the Chinese government has, you know, kind of put on, you know, full measures to do financial deleveraging, and not without success. Part of what we're seeing as a slowdown in the economy is a reflection that they are able to tolerate an economic slowdown to kind of reduce the financial vulnerability. And so all kinds of microprudential measures, macroprudential measures, you know, reducing corporate debt, including housing, committed to not inflating housing despite this huge temptation and the pressure coming from the local governments to keep on doing that. The central government this year has said no, or there's still a lot of debate about that. So I think all of this is good signs. The fact that, you know, President Xi himself has acknowledged that China doesn't need to grow so fast, but it does need to grow at a, you know, with quality and in a stable way. So the financial vulnerability, precisely because of not only Japan, but just the last great, you know, recession that he has observed in the West, coming straight from the fact it was household debt, is a very, you know, has alerted the government on the situation. So they're already taking actions, and that has we have seen a great deal of effect on that. So I'm now today less worried about the financial crisis that was looming in China, but still I think, you know, what is different, and I still think that there's some fundamental differences from Japan. One is if we talk about mobility or just about kind of entrepreneurship. Now, entrepreneurship has really accelerated in China. We know that, you know, out of 7 out of the 10 largest unicorn companies, technology unicorn companies, are now Chinese. Half of them are split between Chinese and American. Part of the reason is that there is this environment for entrepreneurship and that young people see hope. That is not at all the case with Japan. Japan being dominated, you know, very hierarchical, very oppressive towards the young, in the sense that, you know, they see very little kind of upward mobility, and the fact that a few big companies control all the distribution system, that is completely different from China today, which is much more about horizontal networks than it is about vertical hierarchies. And so that's a radical shift of the landscape, and this is part of the reason why the technology sector in China is really booming. And lastly, another difference from Japan is this open mindset. Japan had this incredible privilege, you know, with huge net foreign assets and current account surplus in the 60s, 70s, and then, you know, technology, but it never really internationalized or globalized. I mean, not like the U.S. or this country, which put in, you know, international financial centers, made international currencies, and really tried to open up. They don't really have that open mentality, and that is completely different from China. Now, today, we're seeing, because of the trade wars, we're seeing the first, you know, foreign wholly owned car company, Tesla's coming in, ExxonMobil's coming in, everybody's coming in, hedge funds are coming in. And all they wanted, the Chinese are great, you know, let's merge and become big and better. So that mindset is, I think, also fundamentally different from Japan. And so a lot of people say, you know, Japan is demographics. It's actually not, because China is also aging as well. It's not the number of old to young that matters. It's really whether the young people actually see a chance, a rosy future, and opportunities that matters. And because of the demographic composition in Japan, they have suppressed these aspirations.
Can I pick up something that you sort of alluded to, and which I think we often lose in the discussion? We tend to see China as a monolith, and, you know, it's the president. And but you alluded to these debates around debt, for example, and I mentioned in my opening about some of the discussions around, you know, which strategy should China follow in terms of its engagement on these big infrastructure projects and so on. How do you see these debates, and to what extent are there really open debates that, you know, people take open positions, and or is it happening inside organizations? How do you see that?
About infrastructure?
Well, I think, but about all these issues that we are talking about now, you know, we say the U.S. has, you know, it's battling out through, you know, various groups within the administration and so on. Of course, you can argue that maybe on this particular issue on the relationship to China, there is actually a lot of commonality across the political spectrum in the U.S., but it's true that there are a lot of debates and discussions about how to relate to China also in the U.S. But to what extent are these issues openly or discussed in China, and to what extent are they discussed within the administration?
That is probably one thing the country lacks, which is debate. Maybe there's a lot of debate going on, you know, in this micro level WeChat, you know, that we don't really see. But there's not really these channels. I mean, it's a double-edged sword as well, right? Facebook, Twitter has, you know, create all these silos that perpetuate some kind of, you know, so it has also its problems. But it's true that China, we don't see that kind of debate in a more official setting or more aggregated setting. So that's one key problem. So I don't think there's much of a debate going on how to deal with Americans, how to think about infrastructure and all that. And within the party, I mean, you know, President Xi has a very there's a huge political concentration. I think Liu He, being his key economic advisor, is the champion of economic reforms. There's certainly, as I mentioned, a small group of people on the very left that wants to bring China into the kind of the socialist era, which I find absolutely horrific. But, you know, that exists. But it's true that and this is part of probably, you know, what we also care about in a broader level, which is social control. Social control is, you know, unfortunately, rightly or wrongly, just becoming, you know, tighter in China. So media, academic, you know, so we do see that trend.
Yes, or no, because since you spoke about entrepreneurship before, there was this book that came out a couple of years ago about Jack Ma and Duncan Clark's book. And you know, when you read that book, it's it's striking how Jack Ma managed to play out different authorities against each other and different regulators against each other, and managed from basically coming from nowhere to make it to the top. Is that a reality, that possibility? And
well, speaking about the upward mobility point, it's true that economic inequality is rising in China, but I do believe that China is still kind of socially mobile. All these great entrepreneurs of that era had nothing, right? The Jack Ma's and the Pony Ma's and all these, you know, Baidu, whatever. They came from not government political families, actually. So in that era, to be successful, you needed to court the government officials. That has changed today. All of these young, you know, billionaires made overnight, you know, with these, they don't need to court government officials anymore. As I mentioned, now it's really about these horizontal network and horizontal linkages rather than the hierarchy. So I think that has changed for the better. And a related point that I worry about, which is that today there's a human capital deficit in the government, and it will only become worse over time. It used to be that they were able to tap into the best talent because actually 70% of the people were communists, right? So now with the private sector, with the growing opportunities, there is, you know, there's less of a talent pool going there. But you need people to push China forward, to enact these reforms, to have these open-minded dialogues. And there is a growing challenge in terms of the human capital deficit inside the government.
Well, when I was in China, it's been a while, but they were definitely different constituencies. I mean, you know, state-owned enterprises had their, was a constituency. Yeah. You had different political constituencies in every province. And so there was a constant, you know, battle. And I mean, the whole selection of the standing committee is the sort of the final product of those battles. I mean, they're all behind closed doors, but there's competition in that regard. I mean, I'm less about economics than these two and more about politics. And I'm curious. No, I mean, it's just what I did. But I mean, I'm genuinely curious to see where things will move politically, because I think we talked about what happens with stagnation or some sort of economic problem. Professor Jin says they're moving on that. It doesn't surprise me that they're moving on that, because I think the political stability is directly linked to economic stability in the country, and so they would have to act on that. Well, I lived in India after I moved to China, so I went from Beijing to Delhi, and it was interesting to look at China through an Indian perspective. And India can seem on the surface to be an incredibly chaotic place, and you feel like it's going to collapse and it's going to fly off the edges, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff going on. But India's always had, I mean, and it's hard to speak of 1.2 billion people as one point of view, but there was always this sense that politically, and maybe they were fooling themselves, that the chaos on the surface reflected a fairly deep stability that ran through society about certain things. And they would always argue that China was stable at the top, but much more fragile beneath. And that's a question that I don't think I can't ever know, you know? And I think it's an interesting question to ask, because when we see stability now, and we all want, I mean, we were talking about, like, what happens if China's economy breaks and no one wants it. That's the reason it's so imperative for China and the United States to find some ground for political and economic trust, because we're all sort of invested in it together.
One thing to that? You know, it's interesting, Jim, that you raise India. I was just in India 2 weeks ago, and actually at Jim's suggestion went to Ahmedabad in Gujarat, which is a place that's known for entrepreneurialism. There are a lot of ports on the Arabian Sea. And the most interesting conversation I had there was with an economist who does comparative work on India and China, who said, and I sort of trotted out this idea that's very fashionable in the West, that, you know, India, longer term, you know, has the software that China doesn't have because it's a democracy. And, you know, it's an extension of this idea that's been clearly undermined, and this is one of the things that not in my piece, but that
the Times has written about in this series, you know, this idea that material gains would eventually translate into this yearning for democracy, mm-hmm. you know, that hasn't really worked out as discussed. But this Indian academic immediately took issue with my premise and said, well, actually, we've come to see that China has greater rule of law than India.
Oh,
and he said, and he said, in terms of investment flows, don't conflate, was his advice. You know, direct elections, even freedom of the press, which I personally found hard to take,
yeah.
with the sanctity of contract law, and that in China. There are lots of exceptions, and we write about them, the high-profile cases where a state-owned enterprise comes in and can strong-arm its way. There's all sorts of spin on the ball, but by and large, a contract is a contract. I found that fascinating.
Oh, in terms of contract law, I don't doubt it for a minute, but anyway.
I want to have time for a few more questions, and then we can... A lot of hands here. I'll do three. One here, and... There, and then one.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hong. I was a law student, and now I'm currently in the LSE Economics Department. The question regards to the comparison between subprime loan and the Belt and Road financial program. I think that's a very interesting comparison, and particularly after 10 years of the crisis, there has been lots of academic research undercovering what was really happening. And surprisingly, it was not the subprime loans major issue. It's a speculation issue. Even the subprime loan, nonetheless, the CDS and other financial derivatives, even the subprime loan is comprised of mostly speculative investors instead of those who really have an American dream and want to realize it. And therefore, the question goes to the Belt and Road financing program. That financing program, firstly, it does not have a derivative, and not to my knowledge. And secondly, it does not have a directly related speculative interest. And therefore, what's the real comparison there? Is that the terms of the loans, or is that the other features of the loan that you think will be?
Well, can I speak that directly? Well, I'm not sure we're here to discuss the roots of the 2008 financial crisis. Your point is taken. Yes, the work has shown that subprime might have been on the surface of what went pop when it went pop, but that the derivatives crisis is really what turned the global financial crisis into the catastrophe it was. I was simply making the point that to assert that something would not be built without finance does not eliminate the question of, well, what are the terms of finance? I mean, the people who took out subprime loans, who found that they had been preyed on by financial institutions, while they may not have been the cause of the global financial crisis, found themselves in personal crises that were hard to get out of. And that is the same situation that now confronts Sri Lanka, having had to hand back this port that was financed by China. The Malaysian government recently took a second look at the terms offered on some infrastructure projects under Belt and Road and decided it wasn't such a good deal. And there's a similar rethink across Africa. Now, that is not to say that Belt and Road doesn't present all sorts of potentially valuable opportunities for countries that are in a position to borrow. When I was at the 16+1 summit in Sofia, every country in the region was hoping to get a piece of Chinese capital, and Chinese capital is available and abundant and is finding some niches. But in the same way in which subprime taught us, you better read the fine print, countries are discovering they ought to read the fine print in dealing with Belt and Road.
Can I just add one sentence? There is a difference, a fundamental difference between borrowing for investment and borrowing for consumption. And, the most cases in emerging market crises and all of that was over borrowing was because they financed consumption. So, and same thing with housing, it was financing for consumption. Now, I don't know, I don't even know how to begin to calculate the returns to infrastructure. That's kind of one of the key problems. We don't really know the risk and return. But one would suspect, and I completely agree, it's about capacity, that still it's different from just, you know, consumption oriented debt. So rather than having these emerging markets, you know, inflate these huge booms and putting it a little bit more into investment, I still think that it's a little bit different.
Okay, we had one more question here.
Hello, I'm a law student from LSE. So my question today is about China and the Arctic. So in China, you know, earlier this year, it self-identified as a near-Arctic state, where, you know, if you look at it geographically, it's not actually very close to the Arctic at all. So that, I mean, that
India also did. So
yeah, exactly. So that ties in with your point about, you know, China not being interested in the Caribbean Sea because it's far away from its borders. The Arctic is really far away, but it plans to incorporate it in its BRI plan. So my question to the panel would be, politically and economically, why do you think China is so inordinately interested in the Arctic? And do you think the Arctic Council should be concerned? Thank you.
Can we just take one more question, okay, and then we can conclude? Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Dave, and I'm a student in journalism and economics. And my question is, so there have been cases where Chinese researchers, like U.S. visas, have been denied. And how do you see this trend of the visas being denied because of concerns of IP theft brewing in the future? And at this point, do you think that it's still like necessary for Chinese like academics to rely on U.S. like U.S. Like companies and colleges to thrive in their researches and inventions?
Do we have any more questions here? One there and one there, and then we'll call it a day.
My name is Ija, from a visiting PhD student from Tokyo. And so my question is, like, why is it so difficult fundamentally for the West to believe there's different views among nations, just as many of the liberals believe that peoples have a different views? My concern is, like Muhammad Gandhi, I also, I mean, not like him, but I spent some time in India too, I'm Chinese. So like Muhammad Gandhi was a strong believer of the Western values until later on he was disappointed and turned to that. I see the trend of many very well-educated Chinese educating the West, but growingly we believe this different alternative. They're starting to believe more of the Chinese government. At the beginning, they were really patron of the Western values. So how we should address that issue, what do you think the problems are? Thank you.
And one over there.
Holy cow. Hi, my name's Sunny. I'm a study abroad student at LSE from Newark. You mentioned, Dr. Jin, that China doesn't want to export their values and ideology to other nations, and they kind of believe in this co-harmonious, peaceful world, and they want to provide new global leadership. What are the historical and kind of identity origins of that? Is there anything about Chinese history, previous experiences that informed that, or anything about how China perceives their identity?
You were very eager to.
Well, I've lost my momentum. No.
I can't believe that.
I'm going to gather back. I'm unequivocally not going to. Oh, you already dealt with subprime. The Arctic. I mean, basically, I think that every major country in the world is seeing that climate change, unfortunately, one of the major things it's doing is melting the Arctic. So Arctic is suddenly becoming a source of potential resources, I think, for oil and natural gas, also shipping lanes. So you see a region of the world that very few people ever paid attention to that could be one of the next sort of great game areas. So I'm not familiar how either China or India decided that they had a stake there, it's not in any way surprising, I would think. I haven't studied it closely, but I think that's roughly it. I don't think the West, I don't think the West has this one overriding belief that it's trying to shove down the rest of the world's throat, to be honest. I'm not quite sure that's what you were saying, but I do think that was built into the sort of post-war consensus was democracy and economic expansion under the Western model are sort of aligned together, and that one is good for the other, and that both are good for the rest of the world. I think that clearly there is a reexamination of that at multiple levels right now. I'm not necessarily throwing it out the window, but I think that a variety of the economic collapse in 2008 was such a fundamental moment that I think it's causing some reassessment, clearly. And I think I pass after that.
I mean, to come to your point about this sort of this assumption that Western values are the values. Let's face it, we're in a moment where all of our values have to be up for some significant reexamination. I mean, Francis Fukuyama famously declared the end of history at the end of the Cold War. Well, we know how that worked out. We could spend, you know, several hours debating why that was not so and how we've gotten to this current moment. But clearly, democracy is facing a crisis. I mean, Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, fake news. I mean, one of the things that seemed clearly to have strengthened China's own model domestically is the understanding that after the 2008 financial crisis, China could just take out the checkbook and immediately deliver Keynesian fiscal stimulus without having to worry about, you know, Fox News declaring them a bunch of commies. I mean, that was a useful feature. I was in China when the Iraq War started. I'm, you know, personally convinced from conversations I had with people who are close enough to the government that I take their views seriously to think that part of how we got to the stuff that I wrote about with Jane Perlez in this piece in terms of this new muscular global expansion comes from George W. Bush's decision to march into Iraq with Tony Blair and a sort of reckoning with. I mean, in China, when you discuss the concept of a superpower, it's a very different conversation than you have in the rest of the globe in that a lot of the Chinese elite is steeped in this notion of, well, of course you have power. You know, you're the biggest economy on earth. You get to write the rules. Well, we're the most populous country on earth. We're increasingly going to get to be able to write the rules. We just don't understand why you would waste such treasure going into another country, toppling the government and setting yourself up for such harm. I mean, that was a moment of reckoning. That coupled with the global financial crisis, combined now with, you know, the hate on social media. I mean, it is a moment for Chinese leaders to take stock of their system and say, you know, you can criticize us for our model all you like. You can come at us for human rights. You can come at us on issues of sovereignty, self-determination, freedom. But, you know, your model is not really all that great either. Anyone who's paying attention has to be scrutinizing the deficiencies in just about every model we've got right now.
So Henry Kissinger has a great book on China. I find it to be, you know, one of the minority of intellectuals who really see China from a Chinese perspective, and he has written a lot about the history, the historical underpinning of this Chinese identity and almost cultural isolationism. So China was, as everybody knows, was an economic powerhouse, you know, centuries ago, and it sent the first fleet to the coast of Africa in 15th century and brought back a few giraffes and nothing else. While it had, you know, all these Southeast Asian countries, small countries around it, it was clearly had the capacity to, you know, to colonize them but instead they just set up a system, tribute system, look, for our protection, just pay us some money, some tax, and that was basically it. It's very fascinating. China itself, if we're talking about the culture part, which is the Han kind of civilization, the Han Sevenate was never really a militant, very powerful, had military force. It was actually conquered by the barbarians multiple times, you know, by the Mongolians and by the Manchurians. And every time they were vanquished militarily, but they were able to absorb these peripheral groups culturally because of the cultural preeminence. So it's part of the Chinese pride or arrogance. You know, we call it ourselves the Middle Kingdom, as the kingdom in the world. And so that was the perspective. And you, if you're a big country, you don't go and bully the other small countries. That's just not the approach. So I think we have a lot of historical kind of evidence on that was mainly the approach. And even today, I mean, yes, China has its own mission, has its, but if we get together and, you know, in a spaceship that goes to Mars, I'm sure it's an American culture that everyone wants to adopt, with exception of Chinese food maybe, but that's pretty much it. But American values, American culture is much more powerful in that sense than the Chinese one. So I do think that the history of China is important for understanding even modern China. And lastly, I think that we need to think about electability and accountability. And in China, you don't have elected government in that traditional sense, but absolutely, the Chinese government is held accountable for most things. You know, there's a disaster here, an earthquake there, infrastructure problems there. Chinese government is there to respond to the people and very quickly. And this is not surprising that by Western or international surveys, the approval rate of the Communist Party is well over, 70 to 90%. That's the international surveys of approval rate. For the simple reason that the Chinese government delivered economic prosperity, security, and even safety. You know, as a woman, even young women walking in the cities of China, big cities, you know, they feel safer than probably anywhere else. And these are the tangible things that the people look for. If you ask the Chinese people, they would say, at least today, that the existence and the survival of the Communist Party would be vital to their economic prosperity and, you know, the livelihoods of today. And the Communist Party is still evolving. It would be wrong to think that it's stagnant. It's been evolving and it's been, you know, held more accountable over time. So now, there's surely a debate about what's going to happen politically, given that President Xi has changed the constitution. But, you know, I think that's the question of accountability is even more important than just going to the ballot.
I'm just going to be a little contrarian for the sake of it. I have a hard time with someone saying the Chinese people overwhelmingly endorse the party. They might. They absolutely might. But how do we know? I mean, surveys, I kind of struggle with that one. But and I don't say that like I think the answer is the opposite, that they don't. But I'm just saying I don't think we can legitimately know. And that gets into this sort of systemic differences that how we proceed going forward are going to be tricky. You know, and they just are. I forgot one thing. You asked about Russia. I'm sorry. I don't have a great answer for you. No. But, I mean, I don't think, and I think Peter and Kuyu might have thoughts too, but my assumption is that Russia is a huge neighboring country of China. Having a stable relationship, having stability in government in Russia presumably is in the Chinese interest. And obviously, economically, China is such a more powerful country than Russia. And I mean, the way Russia is exerting itself right now through a variety of things, through essentially hybrid warfare against the West, you know, the use of misinformation, things like that, because its economy, other than oil, is pretty stagnant. I think actually that there was a lot of attention on a natural gas pipeline between China and Russia, and I think Putin was sort of, I mean, they want to, I think the relationship has improved definitely because they can see leverage against the United States, but I would say China would be much more in the driver's seat in that relationship by far.
Well, I guess I'll just add one thing about Russia. I mean, the bottom line is there is no real long-term relationship between China and Russia. There is no real trust. because of the historical events and because, you know, these are founded on short-term interest. Yeah. And I think the triangular relationship, China, U.S., and Russia, is always shifting, and that's how the relationship will shift.
Okay, I think we have had a very interesting and engaging debate on how to engage with China. I just wanted to pick up one thing at the very end. On accountability, you know, independently of whether the Communist Party enjoys general popular support, I think on the accountability issue, there's no question that if you see what's happened to the Communist Party and how it has consolidated its control at so many different levels, and the stand in the strength of the party today and compared to 15, 20 years ago is just extraordinary. So it has no way of escaping accountability when you have that very strong control. So when we named this debate Engaging China, it was very much about, of course, using the double meaning of engaging. You can engage militarily, you can engage in terms of cooperation. I'm very grateful to Kerry for taking on this role of trying to explain mm-hmm. China's position, because you're alone here on the stage, and
New York Times, tough audience.
But I think it is extremely important that there are people like you who try to do this, because it's said very often, and it's almost a cliche, that you know there are so few in the West who understand China and so many in China who understand the West. But I think there is something to that, and I think you have done a very helpful service to us by articulating those perspectives, and that also that there are different, even within China, you know, discussions about how to engage with the rest of the world and what is the right way to do all these investments in infrastructure, for example, and doing it alone, you know, what type of financing and so on. So there are many issues that are, you know, not maybe discussed in the open in the Chinese political debate, but certainly is discussed a lot within different institutions, and I think you have given us a feeling for that. And as for my two friends from New York Times, I think you have really shown, you know, what good and fresh journalists can do to shed light on something that is very central to the future, not only of China, but to the future of the world. And what I really took away from these pieces was that there is, as you said also initially, that there were all these conceptions about, you know, what China would be like and you know, what the West's relationship to China would be like. And many of those were wrong. And, you know, it could still be that we would be wrong about how this evolves. But I think you have done a great service to bring these topics to this conversation tonight. So thank you very much. And thank you, audience.